Hello there and welcome. I'm Luke Clancy and you're welcome to Culturefile, and this time it's in the magazine flavour as we bring you reports from the front line of alternative knitting, DIY monuments and macabre collections. All of that, and Paddy Woodworth has his latest naturalist bookshelf selection. But we begin this time with the knitting machine wrangler Fintan Mulholland, an award-winning maker of knitted things but also a philosopher of yarn, as Culturefile's Niamh Daly discovered when she went to visit his workshop.
I am, I suppose, curious. I'm always curious. Colour, yarn, how does that colour look in that stitch structure? So there's a lot of testing within it, and I sometimes don't think there's an understanding of how long things take to make. I'm Fintan Mulholland. I'm a knitwear designer. I'm based in Castle Blaney, County Monaghan. I did think about fashion, I suppose, whenever I was at school. I knew I wanted to get into some kind of aspect of design, but it wasn't always fashion. Really, I kind of thought maybe product, automotive, architecture, some link to construction, maybe. Even at junior sort of level, I remember making a model house. So there was no fashion, there was no tactile kind of fabric or that aspect, but yeah, where did knitting come in? It didn't really come in until first year undergrad. I got to experience a knitting machine, and that instantly it just clicked. There was just something about it that you could develop fabric, but again, not realising the potential within it at the time because it was such a short experience. I think just the way the programme was, I just had that little window to see, well, this is yarn, this is material, this is fabric, this is construction. I got to exercise that 3D thinking that I explored at a younger age in school. But this was, it just really clicked that I could do that with fabric, and I have full control of that. The experience itself of actually pushing, you know, it's quite immersive. It's a sensory feedback thing, so you're pushing, pulling, and then you feel the yarn, you're seeing what's happening. I'm working on a domestic knitting machine with a ribber attachment and connecting arm. I have yarn threaded up at the back here through my tension mast, so I'm just going to cast on. So the yarn comes down between the two beds. I'll adjust tension to cast on and knit.
It's a linear motion, yeah, so back and forth, and it has that kind of whoosh sound.
I would have used a lot of my own artwork, like physical kind of charcoal texture. I mean, I would go to that kind of medium, and then I would try to echo that in the pattern or the fibre. You know, I'd use like a melange yarn to kind of mimic that texture that you get of chalk or charcoal on textured card, because that's how I kind of visualise shape. I look for contours and lines that as you know, construction lines, then I can echo that. The discovery of the kind of shapes and forms that I'm creating do kind of lend themselves to an aesthetic, maybe through colour, pattern. It's kind of by chance, in a sense, usually through discovery of like an object, a sculpture, a building, a rock, a plant, something that I can see or identify, kind of link something small. I'll give you an example. Climbing Mount Errigal, and I just look down at the ground and I see this rock, but it had compressed layers, but the rock itself was like a parallelogram cut, but the lines were kind of sinuous and curved within this geometric, so there was that kind of play, and I kind of thought, wow, that's really interesting. But that's almost very like the kind of patterns and structures that I've worked with before. Another example would be a monument. And it was, suppose it was the kind of brutalist structure of the monument that I kind of took that as a silhouette and then expanded on that, and then manipulate and place that on the body. I probably looked at that in undergrad. And then I was in Japan for a time and I came across these Jomon sculptures. Jomon, like they're J-O-M-O-N. Again, they had those kind of linear lines, very distinctive kind of contours and shapes. And then I could see those lines and how they were kind of mirrored in the kind of things that I'm drawn to. So then on top of that, I could then nearly identify that sculpture and how maybe that's kind of used as a silhouette in sci-fi. So I'm looking at this monument, I'm going to the sculpture, then I'm going to references in sci-fi. And so that kind of feeds in to the design process, I suppose, and that takes time. Maybe, you know, when everything's kind of click and register and kind of go, wow, okay, there's something here, that's a new shape. So when it comes back to designing, it's not like, oh, collection, collection, collection. It kind of starts off with a shape or a form that I see as the point of inspiration. And then I kind of feel, right, okay, I'm going to take that and I'm going to run with it. I really like just like using natural things and then kind of harnessing their properties into the shape and forms that I like to create and how they sit within and maybe morph around the body. I'm just thinking, even what I'm wearing, it's linen, but it's a piece that's constructed just out of one piece of fabric, but then it's shaped into a coil that is just becomes a full garment. So there's no waste. Really what I kind of observed as a student as well, the process of pattern cutting, draping, and there seem to be aspects of waste. You know, you're developing patterns. You may have to go down a manipulation route of finding a fabric that works and takes form. You're using different materials to kind of get the form. But with knit, you sense it through the material. You can unravel and adjust, knit, unravel, knit, adjust, knit, unravel. So there's that kind of knit feedback thing. Adjust, knit, unravel, adjust, knit. I'm always going to be testing and pushing myself in different ways, but I don't think I ever get bored of it. There are kind of limitless boundaries, but I want to kind of make sure that there's purpose and that I'm testing something. And there's that explorative kind of working process of working with the material machine. So it's just not about creating another thing. There has to be purpose. I think that's why I develop work in a slower way, in a slower approach, that I feel that there is purpose. I'm giving purpose. I think there's still room or appetite for knitwear that's of quality and statement.
Fintan Mulholland there, spinning some yarn with Niamh Daly. Now to the pole of inaccessibility, or one of them anyway. On the weekend, a team led by the artist known as Brown Source attempted to create a temporary sonic monument to the spot in Dublin furthest from any road, wall, tree or built structure, which is in the Phoenix Park, as you might guess. Louise McMahon sat-navved her way to the pole of inaccessibility in the company of Brown Source and his crew of other DIY Dublin artists.
Starting route to Adventuriston Square, Chaplizet Hill Road.
Okay, I thought I was fitted in this. So it's like hiking in 3 or 4 inch heels. And I'm now searching for a house.
Arrived.
Which is the home of an artist called Brown Sauce.
Hi, were you calling me there? Is this Lou?
It's Lou, yeah. I think I'm here. Who said, come on up, sure, and we'll whip up some food before we go and test out our event.
Falafel and pita bread.
So I guess the point of this is when you are not technically paying people for their time and effort, at least you can feed them. And
so as we head up, you can find later.
The pole of inaccessibility basically is this point in the western field of the Phoenix Park where you will be as far away from any wall or road or building or tree as it is possible to be. The reason why that point is important or has been important to me is I have realized that it's a point of inaccessibility. The most famous point of inaccessibility would be Point Nemo, which is well known as probably the worst place to be dropped off of a ship, because if you were dropped off at Point Nemo, you would be the farthest away from any coastline that it would be possible to be. Usually the closest person to Point Nemo would be somebody that is traveling in the space station in the atmosphere bulk because there's no shipping lines or anything out there.
So we're pulling into the Phoenix Park.
I would just spend a lot of time walking in the Phoenix Park and discovering all these different points of interest and reference. Yeah, this one I kept on coming back to, and I didn't really have the language at the time to understand why it was that I was coming there.
On my phone, I just have Google Maps up, and I have.
But I would continually be out there in the middle of the night, early in the morning, straight after work. I work as a cinematic artist, which basically means I make the videos in the video games. I worked on the BAFTA award-winning Baldur's Gate. 53.355104 This piece really is about attention. We've set up the scenario in which you could really notice it the most, with the sound physically shooting the border of the space, and its size will be very apparent, I hope. But we have four artists with four speakers. These speakers are soundbox speakers, which are incredibly loud Bluetooth speakers. Probably one of the most accessible consumer grade loud speaker, but we've basically gotten access to one of these, which I bought for myself, and then two others which have been borrowed from other, I suppose, DIY community projects in Dublin.
We are in the Phoenix Park and we're walking towards the pole of inaccessibility. The performers have their soundbox speakers set up. They have apps on their phones, iPhone and Android, and they're connecting to the speakers via Bluetooth. And we're all just walking around.
It's quite unmarked spot deep within the park, not including any informed desire path. When people make paths in fields or, you know, going across a green, it leaves a desire path.
Actually, Ian Lynch's harmonium that I recorded when I was cat-sitting for Ian.
Dan Callanan speaking.
Yeah, I just did a little session with it and then kind of processed it with various digital effects.
That just sounds gorgeous, doesn't it?
It does.
The performance is intended to take place at dusk. The audience will be invited to gather at the centre of this pole. You see, they're all standing there now.
In that corner, basically.
That's cool to see. Essentially, I'm hoping that because these speakers are so loud that the sound will travel effectively across the fields, we will get an impression of how far away the imaginary boundaries of this pole are. The artists will move in when I hopefully give my signal. What should happen would, for the listener in the center, will be an increase in volume and intensity to a certain degree. And I think because these speakers are so loud, that will be felt potentially intense way, potentially surreal way.
Starting to hear it now.
We're hearing some kind of like light Kimbala sounds from Dan. Very cool. So I'm just texting into our group chat to say sound on. Viva is crouched down, which
Viva Dean
is giving me the impression that they're troubleshooting.
Tig Kinsella.
Tig, I can see, is throwing wires around the place. And he's got the speaker in his hand. So I'm putting my hand up, I'm giving a thumbs up. And as well, you can hear,
because it's sort of blending with the sounds of
some of the
traffic,
birds and the cityscape.
The aeroplanes, there's bird sounds, all the sounds of the park.
So that's also one of the interesting parts of them being so far away, is that it's like there's almost like an auditory hallucination of, you're wondering, is it car background noise or is it 53.355104
Bird
song, comma. Yeah, Dan is very loud. 6.341 Dan's eight, doing a good job. Maybe he's gained all his samples differently. Okay, I can see Viva's on the move. Tiger's on the move.
Everyone bringing their own kind of expertise.
Dan is on the move.
Mostly using kind of iPhone apps from Koala and Ableton Notes.
So that's good, Tiger.
I've also brought a few mini portable synthesizers, kind of drone machine there. I have another sound source device that allows you to kind of get a lot of weird and wacky sounds.
So we're trying to figure out the technical difficulties now.
And then this is kind of the modular, semi-modular thing that I was talking about. So this is just battery-powered.
It's a small little black box, fits into the palm of your hand. It's got little knobs on it.
And it's just basically, it creates a sound source, so you have two oscillators. smashing into each other, which then makes a dual oscillator. Wave shapes, weird and wacky sounds. The timbre modulation, pitch modulation.
When you say Dublin has a DIY scene, what are you referring to?
What are we referring to?
Us.
Yeah, we are. The just people who organise things maybe in slightly
music.
Unconventional spaces.
Yeah, unconventional spaces, places, music, art events, also sport events.
Social events.
Football and...
18-15 football. So
kind of making things accessible and welcoming for weirdos. You know, cool weirdos.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. We expect to see you at football on Sunday.
Even having to turn it down.
Ireland has long had history of monument making, often building in alignment with the movements of the land. So in a way, we're building a monument of sound or marking this place, but in a new way, which is ephemeral and doesn't have to have a stone or a big metal spire.
So the XY coordinates that can be put into Google Maps are 53.355104 comma dash 6.
Brown Source and collaborators there, and the reporter was Louise McMahon. Now, for the latest volume of his Ideal Naturalist bookshelf, Paddy Woodworth has chosen a book that invites us to think again about human dominion in the natural world. Michael Pollan's The Botany of Desire.
Sowing potatoes in his garden one afternoon, under a flowering apple tree alive with bees, Michael Pollan had an epiphany. What if his role, as a human planting seed potatoes, was not that much different to a bee's role with the apple's pollen? In each case, he argues, two species are interacting in remarkably similar ways. The human, in exchange for food, selects and propagates a particular breed of potato. Likewise, the bee, in exchange for nectar, selects the scent and form of one flower over another, thus propagating its pollen and influencing the apple's evolution. Subject and object vanish or merge in this view of natural selection, turning evolution, or rather coevolution, into a dance between partners. This notion leads Pollan to big questions. We speak of humans inventing agriculture, but who was manipulating whom when we selected particular plants and distributed them in an infinity of new varieties right across the world? His position is an insight, a cultural perspective shift rather than a scientific theory. It's easy enough to pick large holes in it. Where, for example, do the roles of self-consciousness and intention, which appear to be specifically human characteristics, enter into his picture? But what it does offer is a new window onto the whole human relationship with nature. It reveals our notion of ourselves as the sole and entirely autonomous architects of the domestication of wild nature to be at least slightly deluded. Not for nothing is this book, The Botany of Desire, subtitled A Plant's View of the World. Yet I feel his thesis is perhaps best illustrated by an example from the animal world that he references early on and then abandons. Most of us would probably consider the wolf the most successful species in the genus Canis. Yet there are 50 million domesticated dogs in the United States today, most living very nicely, thank you, while a mere 10,000 wolves struggle to survive there. His core point can be summarized thus. Human desires form a part of natural history and have led us to interact with species in very particular ways. Our culture is inside nature, not outside it. We think of self-reliant competition as being the driving force of evolution. But the latter may reward interdependence as much and more as individual prominence. This, he suggests, may make nature look less alien, less other to us. He then sets out to demonstrate this by looking at our relationships with four plant species and the desires they satisfy in us. They are the apple for sweetness, the tulip for beauty, marijuana for intoxication, and the potato to exemplify our extreme efforts to control another species, only to learn that it can control us too. His material is anecdotally rich, if sometimes highly speculative. John Chapman, better known as the folk hero Johnny Appleseed, planted innumerable orchards from seed along the expanding American Midwestern frontier in the 19th century. But in his case, sweetness was not his main selling point. Those whose needs he rather eccentrically served were more interested in drinking hard cider than in eating apples. And it was not until Prohibition attempted to abolish such pleasures that this situation reversed. But he also offers a salutary reminder that the European settlement of the West was not achieved only by the rifle and the axe, but also by seeds that transformed American ecosystems. And he makes the good point that standardized production has enormously reduced the biodiversity of, for example, Chapman's apple heritage. Now, we tend to associate biodiversity only with wild species, but it is a feature of cultivated ones too, at least until the market determines otherwise. And this thought leads him to the home of truly wild apples, Kazakhstan, where their native habitat is under severe threat. He visits a unique and vast study centre for apple diversity there. This experience leads him to invert Thoreau's famous saying, "In wilderness is the preservation of the world," to Wendell Berry's telling riposte that in today's world, whether we like it or not, in human culture is the preservation of wilderness. It's well worth following his equally varied journeys through our coevolution with the tulip, cannabis, and the potato, to get an always provocative, if sometimes far-fetched, flavour of the complex and subtle ways in which our lives are intertwined in nature and nature is enmeshed with our lives.
Paddy Woodworth there on Michael Pollan's The Botany of Desire. And finally, this time, to a home for some very curious curiosities. Travelling musician and curio collector Paul Mangan has recently found a home for his personal holdings of oddness and opened it to share his taste for superannuated medical devices and two-headed calves with a waiting public. Culturefile's Louis Scully went to admire.
My name is Paul Mangan, and as of this week, I've become a museum curator with the Museum of Curiosities in Dublin. Performing with the Travelling Freak Show took me on tours across Europe, along which I picked up various bits and bobs along the way, strange curiosities, oddities, etc. And that kind of started to form the beginning of what became the Museum of Curiosities. The Travelling Freak Show released an album called Tea Time Terrors in 2021 and had all kinds of strange songs about characters such as Banana Boy, The Ear Fairy, Mickey Mole, Sally Shortcake and many more. All very over the top, very silly, but sometimes with some sort of serious undertones in the lyrics as well, relating to things like social media, superstitions, conspiracy theories and so on. The reason why I created Monsieur Pompier's Travelling Freak Show was to create a connection with the audience. So I created a project where there are characters on stage while I'm performing the songs about that character. So for example, there's a character called Dr. Moogle, and he is all about conspiracy theories and whether we can truly trust our doctors. Others can't decide, makes his diagnosis, just be well. I was always interested in picking up anything a bit different, so like strange taxidermy, particularly like the most ugly bad taxidermy you could find, peculiar dolls, weird toys, anything kind of Victorian era oddities and so on. I'm interested in objects that tell a story, something that tells us something about the time it comes from that might seem strange to look back on now. I've collected quite a few quack medical devices from the Victorian era, which in reality did nothing but perhaps like give you an electric shock or something. One of them would be the Trinity Nose Shaper, which was an early 20th century device, which was a piece of metal which basically sat around your nose with straps, and gentle pressure would be pressed against the nose, in theory to give you the perfect nose. In truth, it did nothing but give you a pain in the nose. So over time, I'd collected enough stuff where I started to think about the idea of what if this could be my own museum. And having visited a few similar museums across the globe, they really inspired me to say, this is possible. A small scale oddball museum can happen. It can happen in Dublin. Why not? There's a very rich community of oddballs out there in these Facebook groups selling oddities and curiosities online. I've haggled long into the night with a particular seller who's based in Thailand, a fellow from the UK who lives over there. He kind of makes mermaids and all kinds of other oddball oddities and then sends them across the world, but he's a real stickler for his prices, so he can be a bit tough to deal with sometimes. Another guy is based in the UK. He's got like a cave of taxidermy, like very bizarre, ugly looking taxidermy, and I've sourced a number of items from him. What I have here in my hands is a piece of horse vertebrae in the shape of John Wesley, who was a Methodist preacher in the 19th century. It became a trend around a time to get bones like this painted in his image and make fun of him in pubs because he was very outspoken against the consumption of alcohol. So they'd take these objects and dunk it in a pint of beer to make fun of John Wesley. And this strange object is called the digitorium, which was a device created in the 19th century for piano players to improve their finger playing. And essentially what it is a small square piece of wood with five piano keys, which are quite heavy. And in truth, this device ended up causing more harm than good. And a few years later, it was taken off the market. And I believe the creator of this device was taken to court. One of my favourite items would have to be the two-headed calf. It's the only true two-headed calf in Ireland. Now, there is one up in Belfast, but it's fake in the sense that it's two heads stitched together. This poor creature was actually born like this and it lived for some time before passing away. And the owner, who was on a farm in the US, decided he wanted to have a taxidermy to preserve it. I ended up acquiring it a few years later. There was a lot of trouble getting into Ireland. We had some difficulties with customs. They were very curious about what this item was, and it nearly caused something of an international incident. Some of the items that seem to be getting the biggest reaction so far from museum visitors are the automatons, which are like mechanical men shaped like a cobbler. There's a butcher. Someone said the butcher looks like Ed Sheeran. Coming now, follow my lead. I'm in love with the shape of you. And there's something particularly creepy about their eyes, which seems to get a lot of attention from people. I'm in love with your body. We're open Wednesday to Sundays from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. I decided not to open earlier in the morning because I decided people probably didn't want to look at a two-headed cow at 9 a.m. in the morning. I'm in love with the
shape of you. Paul Mangan at his Museum of Curiosities in Dublin there. Louis Scully was the reporter. And that brings to a close this edition of Culture File. We'll be back next time when Rachel Andrews will be in the chair for the very latest Culture File debate, live from West Cork. Till then, bye now.